Good morning and welcome to The Old School, a podcast about a host of things, not least of which education, which will be our topic today. And with that endeavor, I am joined by Herr Dr. Bourgeois. Good morning, Dr. Bourgeois.
Hello, Dr. Miller. How are you today?
I'm doing well. And we're also joined by the esteemed Dr. Rick Westfall. Good morning, Rick.
Morning.
Hello.
So I want to start with a moral dilemma.
Oh boy.
That I need direction with. So I think the last time I presented a moral dilemma, it had to do with forcing little kids to say trick or treat in order to get free candy, which I still claim is legitimate. But so I went to spring break in Utah, and in the course of that, we were hit from behind by an 18-wheeler. Everybody was fine. The car, not so much. The guy gets out of the truck. He tells me that he was reaching for a water bottle on the floor, and the foot came off the brake, and it just plowed back into the back of our truck. He said that, please just let me know how much it costs. Just don't call the trucking company. I'll pay it. And I had friends that told me that that was a dumb thing to do, but I was kind of caught in this moral quagmire. Do I do the official thing, or do I potentially save this guy's job? I'm curious, as two men that I consider to be very erudite and moral, and with your moral compass going in the right direction, what would y'all do? Rick, how about you?
Oh, I'm first. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Good.
My rule of thumb that I've grown to accept is it's never our responsibility to put out someone else's fire that they've created. Mm-hmm. So if it's about, protection of family, protection of, because you don't know. The problem with a car accident is that in the moment, everybody might be like, okay, everything's fine. You can pay the, $5,000 to pay, to fix the truck. And 6 months down the road, there's a medical issue that actually stems from that accident that you didn't realize was part of the accident, but had you gone through the proper channels, then you'd have some coverage from a larger entity other than the driver. Mm. So it's a hard moral piece, but at the end of the day, there are consequences to reaching for water bottles when you're driving down a highway.
Wow. Herr Miller, I'm actually surprised in a way that you made the decision you did, because I agree with Rick, and I probably would have erred on the side of caution, because there's a company involved. That's a layer that really makes it interesting. If we're just a private citizen, you might have a little conversation, but since it's a company and he's not going to pay for it, of course he's going to say that about his job. But I wonder if you're getting soft, Herr Miller, because I think Rick is right. There could have been medical issues, and who knows how much a car costs. It's not like back in the 70s where you could fix something. Now you have to fix the whole body all at once. So what? Tell us your thought process, because I think Rick and I agree that we wouldn't have done that most likely.
Well, first of all, the guy was driving for a Canadian trucking company. It was evident. First, he was young. I say young, maybe late 20s. And it was also clear, if I could be so bold as to make the assumption, that he wasn't originally from Canada. And so part of me thought there's a multi-layered levels of concern that he had, not just the idea of the job, but perhaps something larger. And so I must admit that maybe I am getting soft, but I went ahead and gave him the opportunity to pay for it. So we came back here. We ended up getting a bunch of estimates, and I sent him an estimate for the repairs. I sent him an estimate for a rental car while our car was going to be out of commission. And ultimately he said, well, I can't do this. He said, can we do something about the price? I'm like, it's not me. So once it was clear he was not in a position to pay, then in my mind, the decision had already been made. And he went in and said, just go ahead and call the trucking company. And I ended up doing that. But it's just, you know, I grew up in a working class town. You know, all of you, both of y'all grew up in working class areas. I mean, it is not something to take lightly that somebody could lose their job.
Sure.
But, you know, to kind of paraphrase something that Rick said, a screw up in your part does not constitute an emergency on my part. But at the moment, I kind of made it my problem. So I went ahead and I gave them the opportunity to potentially pay. But ultimately, it has now gone to the company. And so we will wait and see. I'm waiting. They told me the check is in the mail. So we'll see how that goes.
That sounds a lot like GIF or GIF.
There's no telling what it's called. Well, one of the things.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things we want.
I want you to go on the air when you actually get the check and just
talk. Right. Right.
There's, did you in fact receive it? Was it in rubles or whatever they have in Canada?
Rubles. So, all right. We'll revisit this once the check comes in. So, anyway, so given Rick's experience on multi levels in education, I thought it would be kind of a fun topic to broach about. Education as it relates to the state, as it relates to local, as it relates to national, because historically, public education in the United States has been a local concern, mainly because, you know, just for various reasons. And it's always been that way. And so, Rick, I think the first question I wanted to ask you, as a former superintendent, where do you see the role of the state, the role of the national government, if any, on public education? And did that attitude change from before your time as superintendent to now?
I think there's always the conversation of how things change based on how much you see other people's hands in the decisions. And the best example I can give are the conversations I would always have with teachers about, you name it, anything that might eventually impact them. Could be, you know, bonds for improving the facilities. It could be tax ratification elections that might actually, you know, likely would end up impacting salary. It could be as simple as just decisions. It doesn't have to be elected elections. It could be decisions that are being made. And the frequency of the answers of just not having any idea any of that was going on, you know, because the focus is on the kids and the classroom and all that other extraneous stuff for our classroom teachers. And I was in the exact same boat when I was a teacher with you, Ross, at Dunbar. There was, you know, we talked about the things that were immediately impacting us, but I couldn't have told you who the board members were in Fort Worth ISD. I couldn't have told you decisions that were being made that may or may not impact me as a classroom teacher, just because that just wasn't the mindset in that moment. But then as you move through it all and you start getting experiences in areas where you have to understand that more, you do. Yeah. Your field of vision widens quite a bit.
So with regards to the state, one of the things that kind of surprised me when I moved to Texas was the notion of the independent school district. Yeah. That's what ISD means. Right. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know if it was just like the Wild West and everyone was doing kind of crazy stuff, you know, or whether there was a general structure in place and the ISD had room to maneuver within that structure. And so I guess we can start with the state. What does, for example, the state of Texas, what does the state of Texas do for the individual districts? And is it different than what they should do or could do?
And in context of
operations, as far as not necessarily funding, because that's more kind of a local thing, but as far as like the decisions that an ISD can make on their own in relation to what they need the state permission to do.
Yeah, and do talk about the state funding, because that's a big case also.
Well, yeah, because for sure state funding is that's what makes everything go around. You know, in the House Bill House Bill 3, and there's always a House Bill 3 every session. So House Bill 3 a few sessions ago, when the state took away the authority of the board to really set the maintenance and operations tax rate and essentially mandated compression every single year, that took away the autonomy of an individual school board to make decisions that they needed to make for their community. And you always hear from the state, local authority, and locally controlled authority. And really what the state has done over many years is done the exact opposite. And it's taking away locally controlled authority and mandating things that may be different, might be great for certain communities, but doesn't overlay into the thousand different school districts that you're trying to deal with. So when it comes to what the state does, the state, I get it. So there's a state curriculum, the TEKS. And so here's a framework. And if anybody ever really decided to look at that framework, it's about as mile wide and inch deep as you can get in any kind of curriculum framework.
When you say TEKS, we're talking about the basic guidelines.
Sorry, yes.
Every subject must meet.
Right. So when you were teaching your history classes and you had a set of Texas Education Knowledge and Skills, which is what the TEKS stands for, and you were going to meet those. But if you were going to say letter of the law, I'm going to meet those TEKS, you really probably weren't doing as much as you really needed to be doing for every kid, because it was so, like I said, the running joke became when it came to the people who were approving the state curriculum, they never met a TEK they didn't like, and they just kept adding and adding and adding and never figuring out what are the things that we really don't need in there anymore. So it would give teachers an opportunity to actually dive into some topics that they would have, that they could, without running out of time. So I think there's that piece of the curriculum side of what's mandated. There's obviously the funding side of what they're holding back on for the last 4 years and just leaving it in their little, stockpile down in Austin. There should, in my mind, from a state perspective, there should always be guardrails, obviously. I think there's always, as a state, this is what we believe and this is what we want our kids to know. But I think there does need to be some conversation about what can you legitimately cover in the time that you have kids in a school calendar.
So I come from the perspective of testing.
Right. I didn't even get into that yet.
Yeah. And I was kind of in the belly of the beast because, Ross and I have written about state testing and all the unintended consequences. But I was also an executive director over accountability and state testing and all that. And we looked at all the TEKS very carefully, and there's no way you can assess them. Would take days. So it's kind of a bit of a crapshoot for the teachers. They look at previous tests and they have a real good idea of what's going to be there. But so much a theoretical knowledge is not tested. It shows, what's behind every TEK is loaded. A lot of conversations went into that, but you can only assess so much.
And the I'll call it arrogance, but the arrogance of the state believing they have a better test than what is done at a nationally normed level, it is just silly to me. It's when you're asking people to focus on a test that really has no bearing on the long range plan for kids. There are so many different ways that you can assess whether or not their education is working for them, than coming up with a test during third grade and fifth grade and eighth grade and, whatever grades we're going to randomly select in any particular session. We helped actually write a bill, House Bill 764, maybe, not this past session, but the session prior, that was to get rid of the state assessment as it was formatted, but not, you have to have something. And I understand that, but use the assessments that are already in place that kids can leverage and use for their own benefit, and let that play the role of, is the educational entity doing what they need to do.
It's interesting though, and it makes one wonder if we've created a Leviathan that we can't control, as far as, you know, you think we haven't touched on national yet, but you figure national and states, yeah. Then you have the district, then you have parents. I mean, is this a system that is workable as it's currently constructed, or does someone need to be cut out? Does someone need to be lessened in their importance? I'm just wondering, you know, is there a way to fix this without a complete overhaul, or does it really just need a complete overhaul? Do we need a complete rethink and a new conversation about the various parties that have a role to play in how an individual school does things?
Well, I mean, what's the, it's Finland, right? That everybody always wants to point to Finland as, oh, they've got the best educational system out there. Why can't we just do what Finland does? And you can make all kinds of arguments about what different countries do and whether or not they're better. But the point is they're figuring out something. They've decided on a particular system at a national level. And then it's taken probably maybe decades to actually implement, you know, in a way that they can get some sort of concrete outcomes to even see whether or not it's working. So there is no switch that flips from one year to the next and all of a sudden says, here's what we're going to do. I don't believe it's the job of, especially in this country, the job of the federal government to figure out how to dictate that for 50 different states, because I think you're in the quagmire that you're in because of that in some cases. But I do believe that there are some elements of public education that the federal government can support without putting so many layers on of bureaucracy and things that you're just chasing your tail trying to accommodate and to accomplish. And then you layer on all the state requirements, and then again, you're just back to this quagmire. So I think there's always an opportunity to look at all of the layers that are involved and what could you actually remove. And again, the simplest form, the simplest analogy is the curriculum. When you just keep adding and adding and adding and adding and adding and not taking anything away, at some point it just doesn't become effective anymore.
It's interesting you brought up Finland, because it's a bit of a joke. Yeah, and every time I hear someone bring up Finland, I go, okay, here we go. Because what someone wants to do is they want to take one single element, ignore the context, and think that by simply interjecting that into the school system, that you're somehow going to come up with something different.
Yep. Agreed. And you know, there's lots of cool ideas and lots of cool thoughts that come from it. And the other element to that is you have to also remember that society has constructed itself around public education. When you think about like that the model of Finland, and they talk about the number of hours that teachers have to plan and versus classroom time, and how many days are the kids actually in school versus not in the school. And then you go back to the argument that's going on right now in Texas with schools that are choosing to do four-day weeks. Well, the entire system is built around schools they're teaching kids Monday through Friday, in large part because parents are working Monday through Friday. So, you know, so when the more districts are doing, you know, Monday through Thursday or Tuesday through Friday or whatever it happens to be, is there going to be some sort of societal shift then that has to make up for that to figure out how do we manage the fact that now my kids aren't in a school building when I've got to go to work, potentially two jobs, maybe three. And now I can't anymore because I've got to provide daycare for my 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, you know.
Sometimes looking at Finland, the big thing I think is, you know, there's nothing wrong with testing. I mean, we have to test.
Sure.
Yeah. But they don't necessarily have a meaningful test until 10th grade, you know, and everything else is local. If we think about, and we, you're talking, Rick, about the length of the school year and then down to the minute, you know, not just
right.
But if we spend 30% of our school year either giving, say, tests or doing benchmarks or doing direct test prep, that's a lot of time to buy back.
That's right.
And so high stakes testing, take away the high stakes, most likely schools will spend a lot less time prepping for that and maybe more time instructing. So there is a solution, but I think you're right. Finland also professionalizes the profession. And so they allow the teachers to have so much autonomy. And that's a complete shift, you know, of preparation of teachers here.
Well, complete shift of preparation of teachers. And as we've seen in the last 4 years, a complete shift in our communities and do they value teachers? Mm-hmm. You know, before COVID, teachers walked on water. And now it's like, bizarrely, this shift of, and you know, we can go down that rabbit hole way too far, but it's just it's been this bizarre shift of, not everybody, but this trust of of what our teachers are able and capable of doing, even though they show up every single day to work and love the kids who are sitting right in front of them and doing the best they can.
Yeah, and it should be the opposite. I mean, having gone through COVID, Ross was there in a classroom. I mean, they were on the front lines and they didn't know what they were dealing with and they went to work. I mean, they should be walking on water now.
I think the problem is that it's hard to, there are some subjects, and maybe this is just my bias as a humanities teacher, but there seem to be some teachers that got a larger string of latitude than others. But and I wanted to touch on, you kind of obliquely brought it up, but you know, the notion about what kind of say should parents have in how a curriculum is run, how a school is run, that does seem to take away from the professionalism of the profession. At the same time, you can kind of understand that they would have some sort of say or they would have some sort of input. I'm just wondering what the line is, because you know, you go on YouTube and you type in school board and you're going to be in and inundated with either school boards doing bad things, parents doing bad things, both of them doing bad things. Where do you see the line there? I mean, how did you see it as a principal? Because you know, you served that function quite well. How did you see it as a principal? And did that attitude stay pretty much the same as superintendent?
Well, the irony of the whole thing is that it became the mantra of some folks that we're going to give parents back control of their children's education. I saw it plastered on election signs around the community, you know, giving parent back their voice. Parents never lost their voice. Parents never didn't. There was never lack of voice for parents. Parents could always, the curriculum was always online. Anytime that materials are purchased, there's always a viewing. There was always a viewing window of time for curriculum and for textbooks that were being purchased. Anytime a parent would have a concern about something going on in a classroom, or hey, can we? You know, I'd like to have a conversation with a teacher. 99.9% of the time, that's the reason why there's conference periods. And that's the reason why there's teacher-parent conferences. And that's the reason why at the beginning of the school year and generally in the middle of the school year, you have those open houses where parents can come into their building and come into the rooms and can have a conversation with the teachers and see what's on the walls and doing all those things. So how this notion that because of COVID, and I'm going to keep going back to that because that was the turning point of all of this when all of those little statements started coming up. This notion that parents didn't have a voice when there has always been voice. And then the state legislature takes it up and starts writing laws for parents to have voice when all they're doing is rewriting what's already in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ludicrous. But when you give Oh, when you echo that narrative, when politicians echo that narrative, when elected officials in power echo that narrative, then it becomes people just assume that that must be true, you know, and, oh gosh, I never have had voice. And that's just, it's just absolutely wrong. They've always had. I can't tell you the number of times that I would get as a campus level leader or even teacher questions from what's going on or can I have a conversation, or even if teacher, you know, you always have teachers who get anxious about that. You know, I don't know how to handle that if a parent wants to come in and sit down. Okay, well then we'll have someone come in and sit down with you. But it's never a stiff arm to say you can't come in. It's always figuring out a way to do it for those who are interested.
And then you also have the thing where, you know, I think some parents sometimes are reluctant to confront or address directly teachers. I had that problem, you know, where a parent would go directly to the principal or go directly right to somebody else, but they wouldn't necessarily talk to me. And so you're talking about giving up your own voice. I mean, if you're not willing to talk to the person who most closely affects what's happening to your kid in the classroom, but rather you go four levels up, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's certainly not productive.
So let me go back to your question you asked me, though, because I think I was too busy ranting about it. But the question you asked me was, you know, where does parent voice come into the education of their child? And their voice absolutely should be part of the education of every child. That's the magic of education, or when the parents and the teachers are working together because of the kids in the room. But the question assumes there isn't that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And my point is there has always been that opportunity, and that opportunity has never gone away.
So Rick, can you jump much more broadly to the federal role in education? And I mean, people see it in terms of holding a lot of strings to a lot of money, particularly for the title funds.
Right.
Having a national test, you know, politically would be essentially impossible at this point. Mm-hmm. But what do you think the role should be? Not what is it, but what do you think the role should be of the federal government?
Less than it is now, but I can't quantify that. And the reason why I have a hard time quantifying that in full transparency is my experience. I taught at Dunbar High School, but in all of my administrative experiences, especially in central office and superintendency, were in school districts that didn't rely very heavily on federal funding. Mm-hmm. It was a fraction of our budget. So the federal funding came in from, you know, percentage of economically disadvantaged, percentage of at risk, percentage, I mean, just different things. But I mean, there are some districts that they live and breathe by their federal, by their federal funds. And when I would get questions of, well, why can't that district over there do all these things that we can't, I would always tell them, all you gotta do is look, there are three lines on a district revenue budget. And one of them is federal funding. Go look at that number and then compare it to ours and then ask me that question again. and if they're getting the Brinks truck backed up, okay, yeah, they can do a whole lot of things for their kids. But if they're not, then that changes the conversation. So I get the need for money for higher need areas, and I don't begrudge that at all. I get the need for special education requirements from the federal level, and the fact that if you don't have that, there would be some people, bad actors in the system, who would not take care of kids that need to be taken care of the most. But what I will say is, if you're going to put a lot of requirements on, then you better have money to back it up. Because if you're going to mandate things to be done, then there needs to be an equivalent expectation of what does it cost to actually do that. Not just lip service to look at these things that we're requiring schools to do, but then not giving them the resources to actually do it.
So as far as maybe give people an idea of maybe a more affluent suburban district, what would those three buckets look like? you know, just roughly in terms of a typical percentage of federal, state, and local?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, and generally more affluent, you are talking about 70-ish percent of the money that comes into the budget is going to be from local taxes. And I'm going to jump straight to 100%. 30% of it comes from the state. Take a couple percent off each of those things, and that's going to be your federal bucket. So maybe it's more like, you know, 68 and 28, and then maybe 4% from the feds. But again, so, I mean, you can see that that's not going to move the needle very much. And what people get confused about or don't realize is, as every year passes, that the state chooses not to do what they need to do, they're putting more and more onus on the local tax base, which the irony of the fact that it says in the state constitution of Texas that they're supposed to be providing a free and appropriate public education.
And an efficient one.
But let's go ahead and if efficiency is defined by creating two or three different ways of doing it and trying to fund all of it, that to me isn't very efficient and not frankly very conservative.
Wow. Well, that's probably the first straight answer I've heard on that question. And honestly, I was expecting the state to be more relatively than the local funds.
Yeah, it's really, and that's what I'm saying. It's really pretty. All anybody ever wants has to do and is go to any school district's website. Uh-huh. It is very easy to find what their most recent budget is. And there's one page with three lines, and literally it's just the revenue page. Uh-huh. And it's just the math at that point and how upside down it can get when the state's not doing what they need to do.
Okay. And so I guess my world, I work, you know, a lot with charter schools, and most of my clients are, and so they don't have that local revenue. And so I think I was flipped in that mindset, you know, where their state is pretty much it.
Yeah. Well, and so now that's part of that, you know, we're going to create all these different ways of doing it, and how efficient is that truly? Mm-hmm. And you know, all the private school voucher conversations that are going on right now, what the state has done is taken the ire away from public educators as they talk about charters. And now they've all, you know, they're focusing all their ire on these private vouchers. And charters are another whole nother conversation about how the state has chosen to fund them. And to your point, there is not a local tax base for charters. So 100% of the money that goes to charters is coming from the state. So for that to happen, and for funds to still be available, ISDs then have to figure out locally how to pay for their portions. And that's the reason why you get this really out of balance, that the local tax base is really having to pick up a lot of that slack.
Well, there are so many details here, you know, and we talk about capture of funds from other districts. Who knows? That, I mean, that could take days to unpack, you know, the rationale, the pros and cons of that. What do you think, Rob, from this? Is any of this surprising?
Well, I would tell you that as a teacher, I very much compartmentalized what I focused on and what I didn't. And anything that even sniffed of math, I just kind of shut that part down and didn't really think about it, because I have many qualities. Mathematical acumen is not one of them. And so I just kind of, I'll ask my wife about it from time to time. What's the deal? You know, I understood Texas trying to, you know, the Robin Hood thing where they were trying to spread out money. I got that. You know, I understood that because I know Robin Hood, so that was okay. But as far as like the big picture, it always just seemed like a cloud to me. And I also didn't know how different Texas was to other states.
Yeah.
And I don't know to what degree either of you know, is Texas unique in how they structure things, or is this pretty much par for course throughout the country?
Well, I'm not a native Texan either. I'm from Ohio. So I was in an area that was literally, I went to the Centerville City Public Schools. So If you lived in the city of something, then that was the school system that you were in as well, which is right. What's so bonkers and confusing about what Texas does, because you do have these independent school districts that have nothing to do with city lines. They have nothing to do with county lines. I've never researched that, but my gut tells me if we're not the only one, then we're one of very few that do it that way. Because I think every place else generally tends to be county or city municipalities that partner together with, which in fairness to our population and our community, it makes it really confusing because, you know, Keller ISD overlaps onto 9 different cities. Now, primarily it's Keller and Fort Worth, but there's 7 other little municipalities that are that the borders of Keller ISD hit, and that's 9 different conversations and partners with different cities that you end up having to have, versus if you are a city school, then you have one city, one school board, one, you know, all those things that make things a little efficient.
Is the city model, though, can that become a bit unwieldy, you know, if if you have a large city? So do you think perhaps, I don't know, when it started, the ISD concept or the differences between Texas and other states began, but is it possible that that was part of the initial thinking, or is it just something else entirely different?
This, you can fact check me on this, because this is absolutely urban legend, is my hunch.
Okay.
But this is what I heard. What I heard was ISDs were created and drawn based on where the ranches were. And so they drew the lines to figure out how to best get kids to as close as they could to wherever the nearest school was. And it had, and at that time, obviously it had nothing to do with cities or counties. It was just, we're going to draw these lines, and this is where we'll take all the kids from inside these lines and take them to this one place. That's what I was told one time, and then I never did any research on it.
No rhyme or reason. Just, you know, they're just drawing lines on a map. It's like the Middle East after World War I. Europe is just not like a country here.
All you got to do, and seriously, all you got to do is look at these ISD lines. Just look at Keller's ISD line. You cannot tell me that there's rhyme or reason. It doesn't follow a creek. It doesn't follow. I mean, there's nothing. It's just random carved out spots.
The attendance zone is like one road. You're in northwest.
Let's go even worse. Sometimes attendance zones cut into the middle of people's yards. Like, you know, it doesn't even follow roads.
So if your bedroom is on one side of the house, you go to this school.
Yeah. I mean,
well, I actually did teach in Northwest ISD. I taught German there for a couple of years, and on the summer, you know, when the teachers got together, we got on a bus and drove the attendance zone and around the perimeter. I thought, wow, this is pretty big. You know, it took a long time to get around, and these are
Northwest ISD is 240 square miles. And
wow.
And when you put that into relationship, like with a Keller ISD, Keller is 54 square miles. So just landmass, Northwest is 5 times bigger than Keller. And, you know, at some point that becomes insanity when fast growth is happening in a district as big as Northwest. You know, what does build out even look like, you know?
What you would hate to think is that the design of ISD boundaries are not akin to congressional districts. Because then it would seem like that the decision-making process by which districts are drawn are political and not necessarily educational or expediency or practicality or whatever the case may be. So,
you can look at the political lines, and they have nothing to do with how the ISDs are drawn. They don't cleanly overlap there either.
Hmm. One of the last things I wanted to kind of bring up. And it had to do with, and this may be controversial. Maybe we'll shelve this for another episode later on down the road. But one of the things that I was most impacted by was how people saw history education. And history education as determined by fill in the blank. you know, whether it was a kind of a federal idea or whether it was a state idea. And of course, we have talked a little bit about how the state tends to shape instruction by what teaks they decide to put on a subject or what have you, and that drives what is talked about in class. From your point of view, and I know you come from the math world, but surely your experience kind of allowed you to kind of see a lot of this firsthand. What do you see as the kind of the end result of where we are now, where there seems to be this kind of, I don't know what the word to use, this kind of shark and jets like kind of prancing around trying to figure out how to properly do this? For me, I taught advanced placement to a certain degree. I could ignore what the state said about this, that, or the next thing. I had to kind of more concentrate on College Board. But where do you see as the inroad to this?
Well, to your point, I think honestly, history is going to be one of the hardest subjects to teach moving forward because it's always adding on to it because it's history. There is going to be another chapter that needs to be added to the book because we've gone through another decade. You know, math is math, and it doesn't. You can maybe dream up some new theories and formulas, but there's really not a whole lot changing with that. So it's, to me, that's going to be the hardest piece. And even as simple as the curriculum itself, the instructional materials itself. You know, when you're on 8-year cycles of being able to purchase. Well, by the time you get to year 8, how much of that history book has changed that you're just having to supplement because 8 years have passed that wasn't in the book? It goes back to kind of a reset of what's going to be important and what's not going to be important. And unfortunately, that's just going to get into the political realm of who's driving the boat. But as you think about the subject of history and you think about what are the tenets of what kids need to truly understand to be productive citizens in not only just the state of Texas, but in the United States. And if you can just get all, if that's the purpose of teaching history, is to understand your history so that you don't, in some cases, don't make the same mistakes as the cliche goes, history repeating itself. So understand your history and understand how it got us and led us to this point. Then that's the critical thinking part that you get kids to get their heads wrapped around. But to say that there's certain elements of history that shouldn't be taught because it hurts our feelings or it might cause, you know, tough conversations in the classroom. And I struggle with that because why wouldn't we want to figure out and understand the history of our country and the history of what led up to our country and the history of our state and, you know, all the things that led up to it, even the gross parts that are hard to talk about.
It is strange because, you know, I've mentioned on this podcast before the idea that, you know, well, a couple of things. One, to your point that history always continues, although from an historical point of view, it's always suggested that, you know, 70 years in the past, it's still politics. It's not history yet, you know, and whenever you hear about a teacher getting in trouble, it's usually because they start flirting with stuff that happened yesterday or, you know, and not necessarily
current events. Things. Right.
Yeah. Current events.
That's a trap.
But as far as like conversations go, I'm a big believer in the conversation. You know, I think ever since Franklin said, stay away from death and politics, and I think it has made us incompetent as far as the ability to be able to speak about politics and to speak well and appropriately about politics. And the only way you learn to do it better is by doing it often. And as a history teacher, I saw it as my purview that it was my role to try to have these conversations. Now, a big key to that is that my opinion and my perspective never enter into it. I'm more the kind of the guide for the students to kind of discuss it, but it's never my purview to talk about what I think. And Unfortunately, some of our fellow professionals are not quite so professional in that realm. But it's a tricky thing. But I think it behooves us to be the ones to discuss it and to tackle it.
Yeah, and your point, you're describing a facilitator. You're describing the ability to set the stage, to have healthy conversations in a safe setting, and redirect and guide if kids are starting to get sideways with each other, because that's going to happen too. But you're right. It's like anything else in any profession, in any walk of life, there will be people who, and I don't believe that it's necessarily malicious. I just think they just aren't skilled enough yet to figure out how to maneuver that, but they'll accidentally step right in a big pile of it and just not know how to get themselves out. And that's when people start painting the broad brush of, well, see, this is what happens, and this is what everybody must be doing in every classroom across the entire state, across the entire nation. Mm-hmm. Which then handcuffs and gags a lot of our amazing educators who know how to do this.
It's kind of a putting yourself in a series of landmines as a teacher. Mr. Miller knows how to navigate that, and I think most teachers would aspire to be able to have a hard conversation with students, and many just lean on the assessment and picking these names and dates and basic things that are going to be tested. But I would say we need to teach everything historically, you know, not just the discipline of history. But that conversation methodology would apply everywhere.
Agreed.
Can you imagine the joy of teaching mathematics historically?
There you go.
maybe you can't see that.
Your face changes. You're right. I mean, you get a little pale, you get a little intense when you say math or prepare to say it. You know, you kind of, I wish people could see the expression because you're worried that we're going to ask you, which math are you talking about?
Well, I'm in core math. That's what.
Just keep talking, Mr. Miller.
I'll end it there. But in any event, Rick, I'm so glad that you were able to join us today. Yeah. I mean, you're one of those intellects I think that both Steve and I could listen to all day, and I know it's the same for the listeners as well. And it's just fun to talk to smart people. And so I appreciate you having some time to jump on with us. Maybe someday in the future we'll do a part three and we'll tackle math.
Let's be careful about that, I guess. But hey, listen, and seriously, I'm glad you guys are having the conversations and coming up with very smart questions about the challenges that we're dealing with in education. I will question one thing that you're working on, and when you invite people like Ketchum onto your podcast, you know, it does cause me to wonder about your rational thinking and your logic. But hey, listen, this is not my podcast, so you guys do you. But
he's coming back for a baseball episode. So
is there? Okay,
I'm certain of it. You know, you're gonna get all baseball all the time from him. Now he is a great guy, a fantastic teacher. When I was listening to that podcast, I was just thinking, you know, that was a fantastic representation of someone who's just doing the work because they're passionate about the work, passionate about kids. And but I would have been remiss if I didn't have a shot to take a shot at him.
I'm sure he'll have a nice response when it comes.
I'm sure he will. Hey, don't bring it up. Don't bring it up. Let's see. I'm listening.
That's right. It'll be a test.
So let's see whether or not this is a test to see whether or not he's actually listening.
Ooh, I like it. Devious.
All right. With that, we call it a day, and we shall say adieu, Herr Dr. Bourgeois and Herr Dr. Westfall.
Auf Wiedersehen. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, guys.